Okay, well, welcome to our last morning at Elfheim. It's gone very quickly, hard to believe. So today we're going to be talking about Ezekiel 37, a little bit of 36, a few other places too. The Valley of Dry Bones, which many of you probably read about in your quiet time. And we're going to talk about I'm going to give you three stories and then three truths from the Valley of Dry Bones. And I'll touch on some themes from Emmy and Steve and Stefan and Jez. There's a lot of carryover between all the talks, which I hope you'll find helpful. Before I start, though, I wanted to read you a quote. It's by a guy named Dallas Willard, an American theologian. And he says, "We always live what we believe. We just don't live what we profess we believe." The word profess means say. So we always live what we believe. We just don't live what we profess we believe. And I heard that quote a few months ago, and it's been sort of stirring around in my mind. And I've been thinking about it a lot, that actually the way we're living is a reflection of what we believe. There's kind of three truths that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about what we believe about ourselves in the valley, what we believe about God in the valley, and what we believe about the future in the valley. So the first truth is what we believe about ourselves matters in the valley. So I'm going to tell you a little story. I'm going to tell you three stories, actually, that come from when I was a wilderness guide for a few summers. My very first summer as a wilderness guide, I was working. I usually had a partner, but I took my very first trip, actually. We were going backpacking, so they split our partners up. And so I was with a group of 12-year-old girls by myself, backpacking through the mountains. And the mountains were kind of like these Norwegian mountains, these Porcupine Mountains in Michigan. So pretty high, considering the girls were carrying like big backpacks with tents and food and water, and they're 12, and there were like 8 of them, which didn't seem like that much when I started, and I was like, oh my goodness, what can I do? They're everywhere. We were hiking these high mountains, sleeping in valleys often, in this mountain range, there's a lot of bears and moose and raccoons. So those are like kind of the three major animals that you see a lot of. So because of that, every night you have to hang your food in what's called a bear bag. So it's a protected bag. Everything that smells, actually, your toothpaste, your deodorant, your food, anything that you have that has any scent to it, you have to hang it really far from where you're sleeping. So we'd walk it maybe a half mile away and then throw it into a tree with a big rope on the end. So we did this every night for 6 nights. We got to the 7th night, we did it again. I said, okay, everybody put everything that smells into this bag, and I will take it, and then I hike it out, so it's far from us. So I go to bed, I'm exhausted, because I've been leading these girls, you know, all up and down the mountains. And in the middle of the night, I hear some pawing on the edge of my tent, and I thought, oh no. I thought, it's probably just a squirrel or something, but it started to like sound a little louder, like boom, boom, boom. I thought, that is not a squirrel. I don't know what it is. So I unzipped my tent and there were 3 bears. About where Emma is to me. So very, very close, much closer than I wanted to see big black bears. So I made a lot of noise. That's what you do with black bears, is you make a lot of noise. Grizzly bears, you play dead. It's just an aside if you come to the U.S. and you see bears. So they came back 5 times during the night. So it was like a terrible night of sleep because it was just constant bears. And I could hear the little girls were all terrified too. They were screaming and it was awful. So the next morning we were sitting over breakfast and kind of talking about the night. And I said, I can't believe it. We didn't have any bears for 6 nights. I'm just so shocked. And one of the girls was very sort of sitting in the corner saying nothing. Her name was Katie. And so finally she said, oh, I have to confess. I put a candy bar in my sleeping bag because I thought I might get hungry. And then I put toothpaste outside our tent because I thought I might have to brush my teeth after the candy bar. And so she had put a candy bar and toothpaste. And her tent was like a foot from mine. So that's what had happened. There's a candy bar and toothpaste that these bears were smelling. So the reason I tell that story is she risked our life for like some candy and good breath, which is like not the best plan. So when I was reading this story actually of the Israelites, I thought, oh, they also were risking their lives for things that didn't matter. So that's the kind of the cultural context for this story. I'm actually going to flip us back to Ezekiel 36, 1 through 4. Is there someone that would be up for reading that? Ezekiel 36, 1 through 4, and then I'll explain a little more of the context. So yeah, we're going to 37 later, but we're going to start in 36. Can you take yours?
Son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel and say, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. The enemy said to you, the ancient heights, they will become our possession. Therefore prophesy and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Because Jeroboam and hounded you from every side, so that you become the possession of the rest of the nation and the object of peoples, malicious talk and shoot slander. Therefore, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the sovereign Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and valleys, to the desolate ruins and the deserted towns that have been plundered and ridiculed by the rest of the nation around you.
Okay, we're actually stopping before we hear what the Lord says in this section, but I wanted you to see the context. So what has happened is there was a really good king named Josiah, well-named here, who got rid of the idols in kind of the high places around Israel. People kind of kept idols in their hearts and also kind of in their houses. So God had told the people a couple of things, and one of the things he told them was not to intermarry with other nations, because those nations weren't following God. And another thing he told them was not to make alliances with some of these other nations. So the first thing, the first kind of false belief in the valley that these people had was they believed, kind of like Katie, the kid that put the Reese's peanut butter cup outside her tent, that they believe the lie that small choices have small impacts. So that's the first lie, that small choices have small impacts. What you heard in this passage is what happened because of the intermarrying and the alliances. So after these Israelites began to intermarry and began to make alliances with other nations, suddenly they found themselves kind of controlled by those other nations. And then a king, Nebuchadnezzar, you've probably heard of, took over and started deporting the Israelites. So first, 10,000 of them, the cultural elites, so the artists and the writers, that'd be me, the teachers, all of the kind of people that they thought, they could make a difference, they deported them first. They deported everybody eventually. It was kind of destruction, so a little bit at a time. They believed, like I said, falsely, that their small choices have small impacts. So you think about the first person that intermarried, they probably thought, I'm in love. I love this person, so I will... my getting married to this one person won't make a big difference. They married. Or those small alliances that started. The alliances started really small, like, let's just fight together in this one battle. It was these small choices that kind of added up. And suddenly, there's kind of a complete destruction of Israel from these small choices. So if everything was going well and then it all fell apart for you, this is your story. So it's not just their story, it's also your story. The small choices have small impacts. So a second lie that Israel believed in the valley was that God had forgotten them. After the Israelites were all deported, so they were sent kind of to distant lands, Jerusalem was destroyed. So does anybody know what Jerusalem kind of represented for the Israelites or what it was? Why was it important?
The temple.
The temple, yeah. Why else?
Place of God's presence.
Place of God's presence, yeah. So it was their home. It was a place they belonged. It was the place where they met God. All of this was destroyed. So, after it was destroyed for 5 years, Israel heard nothing from God. So there was no words from the Lord. So they had 5 years of silence. So I'm going to actually read, we're going to move forward a chapter to Ezekiel 37, which you started reading this morning, and I'm going to read verses 1 to 2 for us. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. So what this scene is, though it may not necessarily resonate quite as much with us today, is it's a war scene, okay? So we're seeing, like, a scene of mass casualties. So a lot of people have died here and not even been buried. And actually, in kind of ancient Near Eastern cultures, the biggest insult to someone was to not bury them. It meant that, like, oh, not only have they died, but their death doesn't matter. It's just, it's pointless. So it's also saying their lives are completely insignificant by not burying them. So that's a kind of a big insult to them. So also these bones were dry, so that means they'd been there a long time. So we see this kind of sense of, like, the Israelites and what's pictured in this valley might feel forgotten by God. So if you've ever felt forgotten by God, this is your story as well. So the thing is, God has not forgotten the Israelites, and their lives do matter. So I'm going to turn us actually to Jeremiah 29, which is probably a chapter some of you know. Jeremiah and Ezekiel were written concurrently, so, or at least the events that are depicted in them are taking place concurrently. So they're taking place at the same time. So if you look at Jeremiah, you actually find out some context of what's happening in Ezekiel. So we're going to read just a little section. All right. So this starts in Jeremiah 29. I'm going to read verse 1 and then 11 to 13. So verse 1, just so you can see the context. This is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Okay, so he's writing a letter to all the people that had been exiled. All right, and then 11 to 13. 11, he says, this is the Lord saying, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. And you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart." So that's the truth in the valley. The truth is not that God has not forgotten you, and that he does have a plan and purpose for your life. So I'd actually like us to write for just a minute. We're going to do a little bit of writing in this. So the thing I'd like you to write about, I'd like you to think of a recent valley in your life. I'm only going to give you a minute or two. So some recent valley. And I'm going to ask you to think about, what did you believe about yourself in that valley? So when you went through that valley, what were your thoughts about yourself? We're going to have more time to talk about this in the discussion groups, just getting us started. So what did you believe about yourself in the valley? So you might believe that you could have done it on your own. You might have felt forgotten. What did you feel about yourself in the valley? Okay, you'll have a bit more time with that later, so I'm going to carry on. So we've talked about what we believe about ourselves matters in the valley. The second point of three is what we believe about God matters in the valley. So I mentioned this wilderness trips. So usually, besides that bear camp out, I usually had a trip partner. So you were assigned a trip partner who you worked with for 4 months. So it's a long time, you and one other person. And you were leading all these groups of kids, and we would go out for a week to 2 weeks at a time with a group of kids. So it's just you and your partner and a bunch of kids. And we went kayaking and backpacking and hiking and climbing. So my very first year, I was assigned a partner named John, who is very fun, but very forgetful and unpredictable. So we would be canoeing down the river, and I would be with the kids. And he would be off on the side, jumping off a bridge. Or I would say, "Can you take the last 7 kids?" And he'd say, "Sure, no problem." And we'd get to the campsite and there were 6. And I would say, "Where's the 7th? He's like, "I'm not sure, probably on his way." So that was John. He forgot life jackets, he forgot kids, he forgot matches one summer. So that was John. So it was really unpredictable. Very nice, but very unpredictable. My second year, my trip partner was named Andrew. And Andrew was incredibly trustworthy. He was also fun, but he looked out for me, and I could always count on him. If I asked him to do something, he did it. If he asked me, I did it. There was kind of a real back and forth. If Andrew was at the back, I knew that all the kids would be with him. And just like a little illustration, Once in the middle of the night, I was in my tent and a frog jumped on my head. Other creatures that somehow had made its way into its tent, so, my tent. So I screamed. And in like 30 seconds, he was across the campsite and opening my tent. Like, are you okay? And that was Andrew. So Andrew is like very careful and detailed and right there. So I was thinking, as I was thinking about this talk, I was thinking much more than a trip partner, it matters to have a God that you can rely on. But not only that you can rely on, that you believe you can rely on. So I believe that I could rely on Andrew, and it actually made a big difference in how I approached the summer. I felt much more free to have fun and free to interact with the kids, because when I was with John, I felt like I really have to be watching all the time because I never quite know what's going to happen. But with Andrew, I had a sense like, hey, he's in control, and he's paying attention. He knows what he's doing. He's reliable. So I think the same is important with God. So in Ezekiel 37, I'm going to turn us, we're going to just kind of move this passage bit by bit. So this is just one verse I'm going to read. We've just found ourselves in the Valley of Dry Bones. And so God asks Ezekiel, "Son of man, can these bones live?" And Ezekiel replies, "I said, O sovereign Lord, you alone know." So in the valley, as we've talked about, these dry bones are here. It's like a war scene. It does not look likely that these bones are going to live. So Ezekiel could have replied many ways. He could have said, those look like pretty good bones. If they try hard enough, maybe they'll get themselves back together. That's one possible reply, right? Or maybe he could have said, well, if I try hard enough, maybe I can put these bones back together. But he did not. He did not say either of those things. There's no hope in the bones, and there's also no hope in Ezekiel. So there's no hope in him himself. Where he has the hope is in God. And we see that in his question. He turns it. And he says, O sovereign Lord, you alone know. So I don't know if the bones can live. I'm not sure. It looks like a scene of mass destruction. But you could do it. And I see that kind of as a possibility. So we see that kind of hope in God. Another kind of truth we see about God that matters in the valley, so God can make the bones live, is that God brings life in the valleys. So I'm going to read a longer section of this passage now. And I'd like you to listen for the word breath. It actually comes up 10 times in this section. In this translation, it doesn't, but I'll talk you through all the 10 times, okay? So verses 4 through 13. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain, that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, the Lord says, O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back from the land of Israel. Then you, my people will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live. I will settle in you in your own land. Then you will know that I am the Lord and I have spoken. I have done it, declares the Lord. So the Hebrew word for breath is the word ruah, R-U-A-H. And it's used 10 times in this passage. The word that is like set, I will set you in a place. It actually is, I will breathe you into this place, which is kind of interesting. Then the word, like in verse 14 for live, is actually, again, that you're going to breathe in this spot. It's been translated live. And then we have the four winds. It's the four breaths. So again, we have ruah used. And then we have all these kind of examples of breath. So why all the breath? Like, why that word? So in Jez's talk, he talked about the kind of importance of structure, of like the poetic structure and how it works. And this, too, the repetition matters. So that's one of the things I always teach my students. Whenever you see something repeated a lot, you should pay attention. Something's going on here. So this word, ruah, is the same word that God uses is used in the creation story in Genesis 2:7 when God puts breath into Adam. And so This is calling us back. The Lord is reminding us of the original creation. So if we were like not getting it the first time, he does it 10 times so that we're like, okay, all right, we get it. There's a lot of that word, the original creation word for breath. So God is, what he's doing in this passage is bringing these bones back to what he originally intended. So he's making everything right again and new again. He knows, he sees, he's in control, he's there. So if you wonder whether you've missed the best path for your life, this is your story. He wants to breathe life into the dead valleys in your life. So he has that ability to recreate the story. And so that's important. So that's the first thing, or I guess God brings life in the valleys. The next thing God does is he strengthens in the valleys. So I know that Emmy told us about kind of the importance of names in the Bible real briefly. And I'm going to reiterate that. Names really matter in the Bible. So Ezekiel's name doesn't mean God rebukes or God has forgotten us or God has turned his back. What it actually means is God strengthens. So right in the middle of the valley, God strengthens us. That's what the name Ezekiel means. God strengthens us. So I'm actually going to give you another minute or two to write. We've written about what we've believed about ourselves in the most recent valley. What did you believe about God in your most recent valley? So just a minute or two. If you think back to your most recent valley, what did you think about God during that valley? Okay, we'll carry on. So first truth, what we believe about ourselves matters in the valley. Second, what we believe about God matters in the valley. Third, what we believe about the future matters in the valley. So I'm going to return to those wilderness trips, and actually the first trip with the hiking girls. So we were going up, like I mentioned, heavy, big mountains with heavy backpacks. And 12-year-old girls are a little bit hard to motivate to go up big mountains with heavy backpacks. So I often would motivate them by telling them what it was ahead, that it was beautiful, there was some, like a gorgeous view. And I would say, you know, you're going to be able to see all these great sights. And I realized that didn't work at all. They just weren't that interested. But when I would tell them, we will open a package of chocolate at the top of the mountain, they would walk. So the future suddenly looked bright. There was chocolate ahead. So then people would keep going. So I think a good future, believing in a good future, is important in the valley, okay? Believing there's a good future. Sometimes we can get really stuck in the valley and it's hard to see out of it and to see that there's something else and something bigger, something better past the valley, whether it's chocolate or something, hopefully better than that. So for Israel, a good future seemed very unlikely situationally. So as I've mentioned, they've basically, their homeland has been crushed, destroyed. They have been cast off into other countries. So they're not even together. They're in various places. They're discouraged. They don't really have any help from anyone. And everything seems pretty grim. So it's hard to kind of think about a good future in the valley. So when Ezekiel is coming to this place, that's probably how he's feeling in this valley of dry bones. And actually, most of the prophecies he's had before this have been pretty dire. So they've not been positive prophecies. So he's already thinking like, oh, things are not going well. Still, God calls them to believe a couple of things about the future in the valley. The first is that he has promises for them in the valley, and the second is that he has a purpose for them. So promises and a purpose. So I'm going to read almost to the end of the chapter, and I'll just leave one verse. So, all right. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, take a stick of wood and write on it, belonging to Judah and the Israelites associated with him. Then take another stick of wood and write on it, Ephraim's stick, belonging to Joseph and the house of Israel associated with him. Join them together into one stick, so they will become one in your hand. When your countrymen ask you, won't you tell us what you mean by this? Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm going to take the stick of Joseph, which is in Ephraim's hand, and of the Israelites' tribes associated with them, and join it to Judah's stick, making them a single stick of wood, and they will become one in my hand. Hold before their eyes the sticks you have written on, and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will take the Israelites out of the nations where they have gone. I will gather them from all around and bring them back into their own land. I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. There will be one king over all of them, and they will never again be two nations or divided into two kingdoms. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols and vile images or with any of their offenses, for I will save them from all their sinful backsliding, and I will cleanse them They will be my people, and I will be their God. My servant David will be king over them, and they will have all have one shepherd. They will follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees. They will live in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, the land where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children will live there forever. And David and my servant will be their prince forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them. I will make an everlasting covenant. I will establish them and increase their numbers, and I will put my sanctuary among them forever. My dwelling place will be with him. I will be with their God, and they will be my people. So, does anyone know what... Actually, I've talked about it a little this week, but what is the covenant that God had with Israel? What was the covenant? When... That's a good question. So the kind of covenant with Abraham. So,
what is
Multiply, yep.
Become a big nation.
A big nation, right? So he has God's promised them to be this great nation, right? And so what God is doing here, again, just like he's reminding them of creation, he's reminding them of the covenant. He's reminding them of his promises that, hey, I promised to make you a great nation. They probably don't feel like a great nation when they're crushed and spread out everywhere, right? They're probably feeling like the opposite of a great nation. But here God's saying, hey, I will make you a great nation. When it feels like everything has fallen apart, I have not forgotten my promises. That's what the Lord is reminding them. And that covenant is not just greatness, but it's a home, it's family, it's a place to belong, it's a purpose. All of those things were wrapped up in covenant. So the two sticks part, that might seem a little strange. You might be like, what is going on here? So I did some reading commentaries on that, and most commentators say those two sticks are writing tablets, which makes it make a lot more sense. So the sticks in this section that are being written on are like paper, are their version of paper. So it's a kind of wood-like paper that's being written on. And so what's happening in this section is we have the two kind of Israel long ago had been split into two kingdoms, almost 500 years before this section of scripture. And what Ezekiel's seeing in the vision is that one kingdom's name is on one piece of wood, and the other kingdom's name is on the other, and they're being put together. And so this would be really shocking for people in Israel, because this is an ancient divide. So people thought they will never be joined. So here we are taking this ancient divide and putting it together. So it seems like what God is doing is he's writing a new story that heals even ancient divides. So the story he's offering Ezekiel is an even better story than the story before they went into exile. Because when they were in exile, they were still split. And God is saying, hey, I have an even bigger, better story than you can imagine. And he shows it to him literally with writing, you know, with this sort of writing utensils. So if you wonder whether there is a good future for you, this is your story. There is a possible redemption. So that's the first thing. There's promises in the valley, promises of a good story, promises of restoration, promises that God's going to do something even better than you imagined. But there's also purpose in the valley. So I'm going to read the last verse in this this chapter. So 37:28. Then the nations will know that I, the Lord, make Israel holy when my sanctuary is among them forever. So the section there that's really important, the phrase, then the nations will know. So Israel was never intended to just be there for themselves. Israel was intended to know God so that the world could know God. So sometimes in the valleys, it's easy to lose perspective and become about all about ourselves. But the problem with that is not only do we lose out, but the nations lose out. Mm-hmm. So other people lose out on knowing Jesus if we become sort of self-centered and are only thinking about ourselves in the valleys. So what God's doing in this last section is calling them back to their bigger purpose. So he's saying, hey, remember, you have a bigger purpose. Look beyond yourselves. This is kind of a, I would say this is actually one of the most hopeful stories in the Bible. So God is saying, we're going from utter despair, valley of dry bones. God's raising them up. He's saying, I can raise you up like I raised up these dry bones, but I'm not raising you up for yourselves. I'm raising you up with a purpose. And so I think for us too, there's a purpose to remember and kind of recall that God has a purpose for us. We don't need to lose perspective. We, in the valley, we're called to remember that. So the last question I want you to write on a little bit is the question, what did you believe about the future in your most recent valley? So what did you believe about the future? Did you believe in promises and purpose? Did you believe something else? What did you believe about the future in your most recent valley? Okay, I'm going to offer just an example from some friends, kind of an application. Remembering, kind of drawing this together to a close, that the theme of this week is finding hope in these valleys. And that's what we see in Ezekiel. We see, you know, out of what seems like the last possible place for hope, there's more hope than we can imagine, and more possibility of hope. Just an example, I've been thinking through this week trying to figure out what would be a good example. So one valley that came to mind for me and two friends, and I'm actually going to talk about my two friends, was the valley of singleness. We're all single in our 30s. None of us expected to be single in our 30s. We all thought we'd get married and have kids by now. So I have two friends. They have the same name, which is part of the reason, I won't tell you it, why they came to mind, because I thought, this is a good example. They're both my age. Well, one is a little bit older, but they were also single in their 30s. So one of these friends, the first friend, is bitter about this and angry at God. She feels like God has forgotten her, and she's kind of waiting around for her life to start. So in her 20s, she sort of was okay, but as the 30s have gone along, she's gotten more and more angry that God has not given her a husband. And this is, like, I think best depicted by the fact that she will not buy any furniture. She doesn't own any furniture or dishes because she is waiting, because she does not want to buy it before she gets married and knows what kind of furniture her husband would like too. So she's living sparsely. So I have that friend. Then I have this other friend that was also single in her 30s, into her 40s actually. And she was sad to be single into her 30s, but hopeful, and lived with kind of open hands, trusting that, okay, you know, God knows and God is aware. And she bought a house opposite of our the friend that has no furniture. And not only bought a house, but she has kind of invested her life in students and in people. And she said, hey, yes, I would not choose this. It's not my first choice. But I'm going to live my life to the best of, you know, the best of what God's given me. And so she's lived an exciting and hopeful life. She's traveled. She's shared the gospel. She was a missionary for a while. And it's been really neat to see. Like, I look at her life and think, that's what I want to live. I want to live a life like that, where I feel like, okay, even in a valley, I can live fully and wholly. So I think what she believed, what these two women believed and still believe about themselves in the valley, like, my one friend believes, I'm not enough, so God hasn't given me this thing. My other friend believes God has a plan and a purpose, and he's invested in my life, and my life matters, makes a difference. What they believe about God matters in the valley. Has God forgotten me, or is God aware? Does God know? Does God care? It's changed their life in the valley. And then what they believe about the future changes their life in the valley. Is the future now? Is the future good? Is it possible? Can I move into it? Or am I despairing of the future? So I think, just to close, I guess what I'd say is, in my life, I'm trying to become more like that second friend. I want to be a person where when I'm in the valleys, whatever the valley might be, and your valleys are probably very different than mine, but we all go through valleys where I feel that I am hopeful and confident and trusting in the Lord in the valley. So I do have a few discussion questions to close this. So the first three discussion questions are going to sound very familiar since you've just written on them. So the first one is, what do you believe about yourself in the valley? So I'd like you to think of a specific valley. Second is, what do you believe about God in the valley? The third is, what do you believe about the future in the valley? And then the last question is, how can we write different stories for our lives? So if there are things you believe in the valley that are not true, not biblical, not good, how can you write a different story for your life? And I'd like you to be particular here and specific. So I think it's easy to say something like, we can write different stories by believing God. Great. How? So how do you do that? So what does it look like to write a different story for your life in the valley? So.